Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. I am one host, Brian Dunn.
I am the other host, Robert Hookman Jr.
And we are here to talk about all things Spillers. And Robert, we just wrapped up Spillers number 3 tonight.
We did indeed. It's getting deeply late into the night now. In fact, now that we're doing all the after show podcasts, it's literally after the show.
Yes, that's the whole idea, right?
That is the idea.
Yeah.
And it's great. I'm sure everybody's adrenaline is crashed by this point.
Probably.
But it was a fantastic crowd here at Crescent Ballroom in downtown Phoenix. We had a fantastic crowd, especially considering it was a Monday night. We had a nice large group of people coming out for Short Fiction.
Yeah, we absolutely did. And one of the people that they heard tell their short story tonight is our guest. Her name is Leah Newsom. Leah, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hey, what's
up? How are you?
And so you read your short story on walking downhill.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did.
That went over really well, I thought. I think people really loved that story. What was the sort of the inception for that story? What were you looking to accomplish with it, and how did it go for you?
Well, I'm working on a collection of short stories that are connected in a narrative way about San Francisco and people moving to big cities to try and like figure out their lives and often figuring it out and moving back. So,
Okay.
So, or some of them, right. So this is one of the stories in the collection that I've been working on. And honestly, I wrote it during a fiction workshop at ASU.
Okay.
And it was kind of one of those like last minute sort of like, oh my God, I've been like trying so hard to write something and this is sort of what came out.
Right.
And it, I guess what came out was better than I thought it would be, but
well, that's always a nice surprise, yeah. Isn't it, when that happens?
I didn't have any intentions, though. I feel like it all sort of happened organically, weirdly enough, with the fruit and the pianos and like,
yeah, there was a lot of fruit, wasn't there? I learned more things about fruit than I ever thought I would know.
You know, the thing that strikes me, though, is like how consistent it sounded with the stories that I'd read of yours before. So I'd read a couple of pieces by that you'd done before. And it just, I mean, like I said, when I introduced you, it always sort of has this dreamlike quality to it. I actually feel calmer after I've read your work.
He always says that. And that's great because we need a calmer Robert sometimes.
we need a calming force around Robert.
Yes.
And it's just so interesting that you're sitting here saying that, you know, you kind of came up with that one really quickly and you didn't have that much intent behind it, but it still came out so consistently within that sort of tone. And like your voice just carries through all of your work. Tell us about like your writing background a little bit. Like you just recently graduated from ASU's creative writing program. Yeah.
Yeah. So as far as ASU's creative writing program goes, I actually graduated from the BA. Creative writing. So I have a bachelor's in English with a concentration in creative writing.
Now, why do you say it like that? Do not downplay this accomplishment.
It's really long-winded of a degree.
Rolls right off the tongue, I thought.
Right. But I did apply to ASU's MFA program. We'll see what happens. But,
oh, cool. Okay.
My writing career, I've been writing since I was a kid, right? But I worked at Apple for a really long time, and I was trying to write like a collection of short stories about being an Apple employee, which turns out is illegal. And
you
can't do that. And I ended up going back to school and studying creative writing, and I got published in Four Chambers Press and
right, Four Chambers. We love those guys.
Totally. So I just keep writing and then people tell me to submit it places and I do.
And then good things happen?
Sometimes.
Sometimes, not always.
Not always.
Okay.
Sometimes the good things happen.
Occasionally.
So you decided to start your own literary magazine.
Yeah.
I did, yeah. So it actually started out as my senior project for ASU. Matt Bell encouraged us all to have like a literary citizenship project.
Yeah, Matt Bell.
Did you realize that Matt Bell is Leah's former professor?
You know, I knew that he was, big-time professor in that program.
Matt Bell being the author of a little book called Scrapper.
And the Scrapper.
May or may not be popping up around Spillers.
Oh, are you giving a little teaser here about Spillers number 4?
I'm not saying shit.
I think you just did. I think you just said Matt Bell's going to be.
I'm just saying we know a guy named Matt.
And he's awesome.
It's a coincidence. Yeah,
who's a good writer.
He's a good writer, yeah. I think.
It just so happens.
Yeah. He taught me some stuff.
He knows a thing or two.
Yeah.
So Matt encouraged you to start.
Yeah, so we had like a project. It was a literary citizenship project, and the idea was to give back in a way.
Okay.
So my friend Zachariah and I, who both part-time work at the same coffee shop, decided to make an online literary magazine that would replace the aimless Facebook, scrolling or Twitter scrolling.
Okay.
While you're drinking your morning coffee.
Oh, good for you. You wanted to replace that with something valuable.
Something a little better.
Yeah.
I think. We put together issue one, and I did a lot of the marketing, and I wasn't super great at Twitter by any means. And I was I'm going to be good at Twitter. And I tried it, and we got a couple hundred submissions.
Wow, that's great.
In the first round of an undergraduate school project, literary magazine. And it turned out really well. And so we kept doing it. And number two comes out in a couple weeks.
Awesome.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I could not believe the caliber of writers that submitted. I was every single submission, I was oh my God, I love it. Oh my God, I love it. No,
we want all of them. Yeah. It'll be the biggest online lit magazine ever.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the level of design for the site actually has a lot to do with it. It's a very beautiful, elegant looking site. It's very clean. It's not a lot of literary magazine sites, you go to them and you sometimes can get excerpts, sometimes you get three paragraphs, and then in order to read more, you got to buy the thing. But I don't know, 90% of them kind of look bad.
They do.
And yours is really beautiful.
Yeah, because writers are not always good at design.
Yeah,
right?
And it's a collection of short pieces that you could literally sit and read while drinking your coffee. And it just looks really great. It's well organized. It's beautiful, and I think that contributes a lot to it. People definitely want to be in it, and I think it's listed on Duotrope now. So
it's on Duotrope, New Pages, soon to be Poets and Writers.
Well, that's great.
I forget exactly. We went on a listing campaign, trying to get anybody to list us that we could.
Right.
We succeeded with most of them, but a lot of them.
Well, required. Not to brag, but I may have had something to do with adding you to Duotrope.
They require, or at least Poets and Writer does, require a second issue before they okay, you're legitimate. So hopefully we'll be legitimate in February 12th.
February 12th is the date.
Okay. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
February 12th, issue two.
Issue two.
Killer.
Is it more work putting together an issue than you thought it would be, or about what you expected, or what's been the most kind of surprising thing about that process?
I think reading the submissions has been the most fun thing. That's what I want to do. I want to read them. I want to talk to the writers.
Yeah.
It's super duper fun. The marketing side, weirdly enough, I do marketing for a design firm most of the time anyway. And so I feel I'm always on Twitter and
reading
Instagram,
news feeds.
And I'm always reading feeds. I was talking.
I literally just found out about this morning.
I was like, hey, I saw an article that you wrote on my Feedly, and hey, here you go. But
messaging me on Facebook and going, hey, I just found this article that you wrote.
Nice.
I'm in case you didn't see
I didn't know that was there.
Just so you're aware, Robert. Just so you're aware.
So I think marketing doesn't come quite as naturally to me as reading submissions or as, reading generally comes. So that's been a lot of work. I really didn't expect as many submissions the first time around as we got.
Right.
So we read a lot of those within a very short time period, and we were kind of overwhelmed. Second issue, we did a much better job divvying it up.
Yeah, so they don't all blur together, I'm guessing, right?
Right, yeah. There was a lot of times where I was like, I have to take a break, or I'm going to do somebody some kind of injustice for not having
right.
taken a break.
You know, so you're actually the only Spiller, I think, who actually runs their own lit magazine. So from your perspective, from the editorial side, where you actually have to read all that stuff and then curate and craft. What are the things that you look for in a submission that would put someone on the short list?
Well, we try and find a lot of experimental work. Or I did an interview with Andrew Monson like a couple months ago, and he used the word adventurous, which I preferred, because I think experimental might be overused and might have some connotations that I don't super love, but adventurous work. And I think that a lot of the work that we found was super interesting and really good, but didn't take it all the way there. Like some writers might have been like going for something crazy and then been like, this might be too crazy. And then like backed down pulled back a little bit. Yeah. And I think that the work that we picked were the ones that like went for it.
They committed. Right?
Committed. And like, even though I guess it's kind of a risk in a certain way, that's what we've been looking for is like, if you're going to go for it, like
really go for it.
Right. Like, so I think that's our biggest thing. And I mean, I think also when it comes to things that were quickly, easily like removed from our shortlist, it was all just kind of like stuff that we've read before, tropey kind of stuff, things that like thematically didn't resonate as super original.
Okay.
But otherwise, I think the submissions that we got were really phenomenal. But I think that for the majority of the writers that submitted, I think like I want to tell them to like take it, you know, 100 miles an hour more.
You know, like, and that's great because I think that's what a writer wants to hear. But I think there's some trepidation, you know. But once you're given the green light, you know, a lot of writers can really embrace that and really, really go with it. So
I feel like there's some sort of weird cultural shift happening lately, too. I was literally just having a conversation earlier today about this kind of trend lately that's becoming a pet peeve of mine of people trying to say things in a really strong way. They're using really strong words. So it's kind of the opposite problem of modifying nouns with adjectives. Like, it, just use a better noun, right? The opposite problem being that they're using great nouns or great verbs, but then they're softening them with the words sort of and kind of.
Yeah. Oh,
they're saying things
right.
like, it's kind of, well, this would be an adjective, kind of maniacal. Like, nothing is kind of maniacal.
It's either is
it's binary.
It's a binary, yeah.
For me, maniacal is binary. Right. And so I'm kind of wondering if there's, like, this general sort of shift in pop culture where people are trying to soften things. They don't want to be too strong because everybody pushes back against strong words, strong language.
That's interesting.
Well, I think we might be contrasting with like the Bukowskis and the Ginsbergs of the world, right? Like, nobody necessarily can get away with writing Howl again, right? Like, you're not going to write Howl and get published.
Right.
So I think that there is a sense that like softness or resonance is going to work for you. But if you're not necessarily a soft writer trying to like condone it with adjectives or adverbs or something that says I'm hard but I'm soft, it's not gonna work.
Yeah,
it's not gonna read genuine. Like, you can be hard as long as you're doing it appropriately and you're rendering it well.
Yeah, just be authentic is what you're saying.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think authentic is good, but I think like structurally sound too. I think we have a lot of stuff that like with some revision would be fucking phenomenal, right? Like,
wow. Yeah.
And so really looking at your pieces and looking at, like, the assonance that you have and, like, the acoustics that you're working with and actually going through and picking every sentence and being like, does this start with, like, subject, preterite, you know? Like, maybe you shouldn't necessarily start every sentence subject, preterite.
Mm-hmm. Right,
know?
Right, yeah.
On a detail note, right? Because that'll make and break a publication.
Yeah, that wears thin super quickly. Just sentence variation is just such a huge thing. It will propel a story. It will sort of create some marks of writing experience. And I think a lot of people, especially newbie writers, I think, try to sound writerly when really the best thing you can probably do is just try to sound like yourself.
Yeah, sounding writerly is a bad idea.
Yeah, because anybody who's ever tried to sound writerly has just ended up sounding like crap to me. So, just try to sound like yourself on your best day, you know?
Yeah.
That's the thing that
that's
does
solid advice. Solid
yeah.
advice.
It's very heartwarming stuff, isn't it?
It really is.
You be you.
You be you, and we're okay with that. So I want to ask you about your 1973 Vespa Rally.
Oh, yeah.
180. Yeah, I do. I want to know. Why are you laughing when I say that?
No, I just think it's funny that somehow you found that.
Yeah, of course we found that. You know, we do our research here on the podcast. Yeah. We're not flying blind here, Leah. If that's
we have a
what
massive
you're...
research team, in fact.
We do.
I guess so. The two of you, right?
The two of us, absolutely.
It's 10 fingers. It's plenty.
We're just scouring. So do you still have that? Do you still?
Yeah.
Okay. You're still riding it?
Yes. It's gorgeous.
Oh, really?
It's beautiful. It's beautifully restored. So my fiance, who owns Copper State Tattoo, which we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, let's get a plug in there.
Yeah, Copper State Tattoo.
Specializing in Japanese tattoos? Can we say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Him. Yeah. No, there's a lot of artists there.
Right.
Or there's five, and they're all awesome. Nice. Anyway, before he was a tattooer, he went to MMI.
Oh, sure.
Motorcycle Mechanics Institute.
Yes, very popular tech school here.
Lots of people go there. Not many of them end up doing much with it, but...
And it floods Phoenix with young motorcycle mechanics.
It does, yes.
Who can work for 12 cents an hour. So.
Right. Anyway, he actually went because he was like an old like mod guy in the 90s and like super into scooters, old Vespas, Lambrettas, stuff like that.
Cool.
He had a Lambretta when he was like 16 or 17 or when I was a toddler. And
wait a second. I'm doing
there's
the
an
math.
Age difference.
I was just going to say, okay, there is. All right. Yeah. All right.
He's 14 years older than me.
Okay, cool.
But he went to MMI in the effort to like restore old scooters. And it's been kind of like a passion project for him. Even though he's a tattooer now, he like still loves. We have 4 Vespas in our yard right now.
In your yard?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you?
Well, side yard. Like.
Okay, I was going to ask front
carport
yard. Okay.
Ish. All right. I live in Coronado, so like yards are sort of ambiguous.
Okay,
all
right.
Sort of like all over the place. Historic neighborhoods, you know? Like,
sure.
They don't really actually have driveways or garages. But so he has a Vespa P200, 79, I think.
Okay.
And then we have 268 Supers.
Wow.
And then I have my 73 Rally.
Your Rally, yeah.
And that one was done, restored by this guy named Eric Lucier, who owns a scooter shop called Second Avenue Scooters. And he's like a world-renowned scooter restoration guy. He has people like from Australia that ship him Lambrettas.
Oh my gosh.
And he like... He's known originally for like paint jobs, like he was a pinstriper for like old car shops and stuff.
Yeah.
And but he's a scooter guy, and he also does like old Volkswagens. He's got like a big old Volkswagen truck thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
That he like rolls the scooters up into.
Does he?
Yeah, it's super fun. His
That's
house
super
is
cool.
Like the most amazing place I've ever been.
Nice.
But he's like an old mall guy too, and so like we go over there at least once a week or so. We ride over there and like check out his scooter shop, and we talk about Quadrophenia and Stone Roses and, you know,
nice.
Whatever else they talk about when you're a scooter person. And
Quadrophenia is up there. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. Number one, Quadrophenia. And then like what Fred Perry you're wearing this week, right? But my scooter is beautiful. It actually, we found it in his lot. And it had been on fire at some point, and it was just like a destroyed frame.
Wow.
And
okay.
He rebuilt the whole thing. New motor, new everything.
Nice.
It has about 100 miles on it.
About 100 miles?
Yeah.
That's it.
We just got it, yeah.
Oh,
and,
awesome.
So it's like mocha brown because I'm a coffee person. And it's
makes sense.
Gorgeous. Even the speedometer is original. He like mailed it to Los Angeles to have some guy he knows that restores old speedometers fix the speedometer and then mailed it back.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
I love that
yeah.
attention to detail.
It's gorgeous. So it's like it's a 4-speed, all manual. It takes way too much effort to start
Does it?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Like, lots of things you gotta like pull out and like.
Is there a hand crank anywhere? Is that?
There's a kickstart.
Oh, okay. All right.
A choke and a kickstart, I think, is what she's referring to.
It is a choke. And then apparently how you find out if you're out of gas is it just ends.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Just abruptly.
Then, you don't have a reserve tank?
You put it on reserve, and then you kickstart it again.
Oh, you do, yeah.
And then you're like, okay, now I gotta go to a gas station. But you have to like almost die every time you run out of gas.
Oh, my gosh.
You have
that
to keep
so
close
awesome.
Track of the mileage, because then like that's the only way to know. If you're
my
about,
gas tank is full all the time. I go to the gas station every fucking time I go.
Smart woman.
I drive to the curb, I stop for gas.
Yeah.
And to the street, stop for gas.
But it's like super efficient.
Yeah. You get, like 50, 60, 70 miles a gallon.
Crazy. Yeah. I feel it.
I love that.
Those old tiny engines like that will go for days.
Yeah, it's a little two-stroke.
Unless you drive anywhere.
Yeah, I go to my office and back on it in less than a mile.
And stop for gas.
Less than a mile. Yeah, and stop for gas every time.
Wow,
so.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I'll tell you what. So we really loved having you for Spillers number 3. Thank you so much for reading for us. And so for those of you who are not fortunate enough to hear Leah read in person, episode 13 of the podcast is going to be the recording of her live reading. So please check that out. And Leah, much continued success with Spilled Milk.
Thanks.
And good luck on the MFA application. I'm sure that's going to come back. Did you say you're going to hear about that soon?
Soon.
All right.
We shouldn't say it too loudly in case it doesn't work out.
Okay.
It's like this fun, embarrassing thing that
well,
happened.
Then, okay, we're going to scratch that. We're going to pretend like we didn't even say that. But thank you so much for being part of the podcast. We appreciate having you.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Leah.
Bye.